Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 565, titled Middle East Matrix, He Who Tells the Truth Gets Chased Out of Nine Villages, Part 2. This is being recorded on August 20th of the year 2006. At the end of this side, time permitting, I'm going to give listeners the URLs for a number of websites that have a tremendous amount of information on them. As time goes, as time progresses, it is increasingly important for those of you who want to get the most out of the For the Record experience to use the vast amount of information available in both print and audio on the internet. And with the sequence of programs, each will be self-contained, but they will be related to one another. The sequence of programs that I'm now going to be doing, it will be increasingly important to use the internet. Indeed, I'm going to be doing something over the next several programs that I undertake with great emotional and professional reluctance. I'm going to be talking not only about the Middle East situation, but about the Israeli-Palestinian issue, or the Israeli-Arab conflict, really. Something that is extremely polarized in terms of the emotional reactions that are elicited by that issue, and also one on which people on both sides, particularly on the pro-Arab slash pro-Palestinian side, are badly misinformed, and that misinformation is a result, really it's disinformation, and it is deliberate, and not on the part of those individuals in most cases, but rather they have been purposefully lied to. There is a series of motion pictures that garnered a lot of publicity in the late 90s and early part of the 21st century. I'm talking, of course, about the Matrix films. The basic premise of those films is that human beings are being controlled, in this case by machines, that have encased them in a cognitive slash perceptual matrix, an envelope, which provides them with their sensory and cognitive input, and yet it is fundamentally wrong. The world as it actually exists is fundamentally different from the perceptions of those humans who lie inside of the Matrix. One of my favorite quotes comes from Winston Churchill, who said, quote, "Sometimes it's not enough to do one's best. Sometimes one has to do what is necessary." Well, I have, although I certainly touch on the Arab-Israeli issue, it's not something I spend a lot of time on for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, in terms of its inherent, intrinsic economic impact, there is zero. Last week in my interview with John Loftus, we talked about the role of economics in politics, and he said that although some people feel politics is personality, he feels it's economics. I agree completely that if you really want to understand political process, one has to understand the manifestations, the social and political manifestations of great wealth, because great wealth is what yields great military, great political power, and also, by the way, eventually great military power as well. And in terms of Israel, Israel has no economic significance whatsoever. There is no oil in Israel. There is no gold. There is no bauxite. There is no iron ore. There is no titanium. There is no hydroelectric power. There are no vast stretches of timberland or anything else. The only thing that area has in it now is Jews, and there is no economic impact. Israel has a little bit of high tech. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny sliver of land, and yet look at the tremendous importance that is attached to this economically worthless area. It might be the most economically worthless area in the entire Middle East. There is a reason why there is so much emotional input into this issue and why people are so badly misinformed. A lot of the misinformation has to do with economics, and oil obviously has something to do with that. The fact that, as we touched on last week, the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic fascist organization, is seen by the multinational slash globalization crowd as a wonderful vehicle for privatization and globalization and corporatism in the third world, the Muslim world in particular, that has a lot to do with it. Oil has an awful lot to do with it. Not just oil per se, but reinvested oil wealth. I could make a lot of this relatively simple with a few little manifestations of the Socratic method in combination with a couple of riddles. Let's start with this. Does Israel have oil? And the answer obviously is no. Do the Arabs have oil? Well, the answer obviously is yes. Does oil yield wealth and political power? The obvious answer is yes. Second question, last time you filled up the gas tank of your car, did you fill it up with A, matzo ball soup, or B, gasoline? Well, the answer is obvious. Third question, the president and vice president of the United States are A, rabbis, B, petroleum industry CEOs from the state of Texas. Well, again, the answer to that is rather obvious. That, in a way, sort of frames the whole debate. But over the next several weeks, I'm going to be recording programs dealing with the Middle East matrix. Not only the deliberate distortion of journalistic input with regard to the conflicts itself. The last war in Lebanon was particularly striking in this regard. Some of it was conspiratorial. Some of it was phenomenological. But the viewpoint on the latest conflict in the Middle East, the latest upflaring of this long 50-plus year war, was fundamentally misrepresented, not only in the West, but I suspect to an even greater extent in the Arab world. We'll be talking about that. We will also be talking about how this matrix has entailed a deliberate distortion of the history. Now, the Israeli-Palestinian thing, as I said in the beginning, is as conflicted and as irrational, as emotionally incendiary as anything I've ever dealt with. The basic reactions of people in connection with the Israeli-Palestinian issue and the Arab-Israeli issue, it's very much like the O.J. Simpson case in terms of just the venality with which people react and the extent to which they have been fundamentally misinformed. I'm going to talk about the O.J. case in some length, simply by way of comparing it with this. And I'm going to talk about the history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, although that is not a subject on which I have been archiving material. So I will sum up that conflict. I'll give you a few references. Some of that, though, you're going to have to just do a little bit of homework, because I have limited resources, limited income, limited storage space, and I just can't save every article and buy every book and maintain that. And for that reason, I've not been physically archiving or databasing information on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But people have been misinformed about that, as they have been about the O.J. case. For example, to make a long story short, with the O.J. Simpson case, a week after Nicole and Ron were killed and O.J. was indicted, or actually the information was submitted to the grand jury, which refused to indict O.J., which most people don't know, a report was submitted to Marcia Clark by three deputy district attorneys, including a woman named Lucian Coleman, a 17-year veteran of the DA's office. Now, people should be aware that generally assistant DAs do not help the defense in a capital murder case, but what they submitted to Marcia Clark a week after the killings was a report that Mark Furman, who conducted the search of O.J.'s premises, completely illegal, by the way, was boasting all over the West L.A. police station of having had a sexual affair with Nicole. Whether or not that was accurate, and there are indications that it may have been, or whether or not that was just locker room BS, is not important. What is significant about that is that the officer who conducted the illegal search of the alleged perpetrator's premises was having an affair with one of the victims, or was talking about it. That's very significant. Mark Furman was also, according to information in the LAPD personnel files, the head of a white supremacist group within the Los Angeles Police Department called WASP, an acronym for White Anglo-Saxon Policeman. This information was in the LAPD personnel files. OJ and Nicole had been getting death threats from white supremacists, including warnings delivered by white supremacist elements associated with LAPD, but that information was blocked from being introduced as evidence in the trial. It was blocked by Judge Lance Ito, whose wife was not only the highest-ranking female member of the LAPD, but was Mark Furman's former watch commander and it had to discipline Mark Furman for writing KKK on the Martin Luther King holiday on the calendar in the station. She says that she had no memory of Mark Furman. If you believe that, well, contact me through Spitfire. I've got a real estate deal in Florida for you. Ultimately, too, in addition to the fact, obviously, that Ito had a conflict of interest, his wife was Furman's watch commander. She'd had to discipline Furman for white supremacist-related activities. He was head of a white supremacist group within LAPD, according to the info in LAPD personnel files, and yet that was not introduced into evidence. And during the pretrial hearing, Mark Furman lied on the stand about where he was and what he was doing the night of the killings. He said he was at a Police Protective League barbecue in La Quinta, California, which in fact had taken place the night before the killings. That, those pieces of information taken into account in and of themselves would certainly be enough for a grand jury to indict Mark Furman for the murder, and it might be enough for them to convict under the consciousness of guilt principle. But there's a whole lot of other stuff about the O.J. case that is very, very relevant. I'll talk about that down the line. But people weren't told about that. People are dependent on the media for their perceptions of things. There is a passage from Mein Kampf, Hitler's autobiography and political manifesto, in which Hitler writes, "Most people tell little lies. They would be ashamed to tell big ones. They would never credit others with such great impudence as the complete reversal of facts. Even explanations would long leave them in doubt and hesitation, as any trifling detail would dispose them to accept a thing as true. All good liars know this, therefore, and stop at nothing to achieve this end." I think the concept of the big lie is something that many people are at least superficially familiar with, and that perhaps in and of itself renders the whole concept facile, so that when people who are inside of the media matrix, when people whose perception of events is being fundamentally and in many cases deliberately altered by the mediating entity, that entity that mediates between the physical event and the cognitive processes of the people inside of the matrix, it simply never occurs to them that they're being lied to. They would never credit others with such great impudence as the complete reversal of facts, as Hitler wrote. That was the case with the O.J. case. It's a case with a great deal of what's going on in the world. Simply with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian issue, one that I will be covering with considerable reluctance down the line. What a lot of people don't realize, first of all, is that the UN resolution which established Israel also called for the establishment of a Palestinian state. The Palestinians made no effort to do that. That's basically where we stand right now. Things just have been frozen in time for about 50 years, but a lot of things people are simply not told. One of the things that one must understand in order to properly analyze the Israeli-Arab conflict, that is to understand a word called Mizrahi, M-I-Z-R-A-H-I. How many of you think now have ever heard that word? Because most people haven't. And if you haven't, and you probably haven't, you don't understand the Middle East conflict. This is not something for which any individual should be faulted, but rather it doesn't get told. And part of that is because of economic factors, but part of that is because of anti-Semitism. Just as part of the OJ thing was the media lying, part of it was a lot of people stood to make a lot of money by making their reputations in this case, but a lot of it was racism. When all was said and done, O.J. was an N-word, and when all is said and done, the Israelis are K-words. And that should not be misunderstood. The Mizrahi, basically, after the Israeli War of Independence, and by the way, after that, a number of the Palestinians chose to live in peace, albeit a relatively uneasy one. That's why there are 1.4 million Israeli Arabs today, something you never hear about. Well, you heard about it in this past war, because some of them were getting bombarded. But after the Israeli War of Independence, over the course of the next 20 to 30 years, many of the Arab countries ethnically cleansed their Jewish populations. They confiscated their property and basically forced them to emigrate. And basically, the number of Jews forced from the Arab countries actually, by most accounts, considerably exceeds the original number of Palestinians that were displaced when Israel was created. But those Mizrahi, as they are called, those displaced Middle Eastern Jews who were ethnically cleansed from Arab countries over the 2 to 3 decades following the War of Independence, most of them settled in Israel. And they are the foundation of right-wing Israeli electoral politics. They are the epicenter of the electoral base of the Likud party, elements of which have an overt fascist past. They are the epicenter of the most reactionary elements in society. Most of the settlers in the occupied territories are Mizrahi. They were uprooted from the Arab countries, and their attitude, not surprising, I'm not saying it's right, but their attitude, not surprisingly, is F the bleepin' Arabs and F the Palestinians in particular. It is our turn now, and we're gonna get them back, basically. The cycle of violence, as it has been discussed, is exemplified with that. But that's something most people don't understand, and there's a reason why they haven't been told. Also, for example, and we're going to go into the whole history at greater length in weeks to come, in 2000, when Yasser Arafat walked out of the Camp David Accords, he basically turned his back on something which, among other things, would have set up a common market between the Israelis and the Palestinians, which would have been the best thing that could have happened to both countries. What this would have done was to create an economic union between Israel and the Palestinians. There also was going to be a $30 billion reconstruction fund, but that would have not only bound the Israelis and Palestinians together economically in a positive framework, and I have a low opinion of human nature, and my feeling is at least past a point that if you expect man to stop lifting, if you expect nation to stop lifting up sword against nation, nor should they learn war anymore, you're really only going to get them to do so when to do so threatens their investment portfolio. Just human nature, and I think it's basically selfish. But that would have been a great thing. But you never hear about that. You never hear about the fact that there was going to be a common market. It's important because after that, after the Palestinian rejection of a common market, and then on top of that starting a war, the Second Intifada, a large percentage of the Israeli population just said, bleep it, that there's no way there's ever going to be peace. They despaired of any successful peaceful resolution. Also after the evacuation of Gaza, one of the things that was not discussed in connection with that is the fact that when Gaza was occupied by Jewish settlers, many of whom one should not lose sight of were Mizrahi, one of the things that they did was to develop a very, very classy hydroponic organic vegetable growing business, which provided Israel with a large percentage of its hard foreign currency, somewhere between 10 and 25%. It was one of the reasons why a lot of Israeli society was against abandoning Gaza, because it was significant for the Israeli economy. Again, because that vegetable business provided, most of them were marketed in Europe, that provided Israel with a nice chunk of its hard foreign currency. Prior to the Israeli evacuation of Gaza, a group of wealthy American Jews ponied up some millions of dollars through the Gates Foundation, the philanthropic vehicle of Bill Gates, and bought not only the hydroponic vegetable growing warehouses facilities, but the warehouses in which the vegetables were stored prior to be shipped to market, specifically as a gift to the Palestinians. This would have provided the Palestinians with not only 24,000 good jobs, which they desperately need, but because the Palestinians are extremely poor, and that is one of the founts of the whole incendiary process, so to speak. But beyond that, it would have given the Palestinians an economic operation which provided Israel with a nice chunk of its hard currency and could have done the same for the Palestinians. Those facilities lasted one day. The Palestinians went right in and trashed them. And what little optimism there might have been in Israel about the possibilities for peace was basically extinguished at that point. And that's one of the things people don't know, is the economic aspects of the whole thing. Then Hamas came to power. It's a branch, Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, an Islamic fascist group, and they began using the Gaza Strip to bombard Israel. But those are aspects of the things that people do not hear about. I'm going to be going into that at greater length, but just as was the case with the O.J. Simpson case, which I'm going to outline at greater length, so too with the Israeli-Palestinian situation, people have not been told really essential information, information that is essential to accurately understand the situation. That is true with regard to the entire history in that part of the world, and it is particularly true with the Israeli-Palestinian conflicts in recent years and with the Lebanese War. Hence the title, Middle East Matrix. And again, there's an old Turkish proverb that I like a lot. He who tells the truth gets chased out of 9 villages. Anybody who's ever done what I'm going to be doing over the next several weeks knows exactly where that's at. So that's what we're going to be approaching, and there are a number of different things that I'm going to be talking about. I will visit a number of pieces of the subject material this evening, in this broadcast, and will then be revisiting the various components at much greater length in other programs in this sequence. Again, each show will be self-contained, but they will be related. To give you an idea of what it is like at my end, I should also perhaps premise this whole thing, that although I am not an unqualified supporter of anything, I am a supporter of Israel, although I am not a Zionist by any stretch of the imagination. Most people who use that term, particularly in an accusatory sense, have no idea what the word actually means. Look it up in a dictionary. I'm not going to define it for you. The reason why I'm basically supportive of Israel is because in its foundations, their cause is just. That's also not to say that there aren't plenty of Israelis of one type or another, or Jews of one type or another, who are, to say the least, not candidates for sainthood. In that regard, I'm going to repeat something that I have spoken about before, including last week, and that I will repeat again. When the ADL had a spying operation in the Bay Area in the 80s, spying upon, among other things, interests perceived as hostile to Israel, my old CD duplication service Archives on Audio, or actually tape duplication service in those days, was one of the focal points, and I'm sure that is because at various junctures for almost a quarter of a century, beginning in 1982, I have spoken about the fascist element within the Zionist movement. And again, as we speak in August of 1986, I first did that, or of 2006, I should say, I first did that in the fall of 1982, almost a quarter of a century ago. For those people, and there have been quite a few, say, you never say anything critical about Israel, blah, 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 blah. Just do a Google, go to the Spitfire website, go to the search function, it basically accesses the Google indexed archives. Do a search on Zionist and fascist, quote, Zionist, unquote, plus, quote, fascist, unquote, and see what you find. I had some individual who claimed that you never talk about that, and I sent them an email. I don't usually correspond with listeners. I sent them an email pointing out that there are about 4 pages of references if you Google it intelligently. But this is an hysterical issue, and I'm going to be downloading information over the next several weeks that basically, hopefully, will enable people to pierce the matrix. Bottom line, it also is as complicated as this sequence of programs is going to be. At the same time, it has never been, in a certain basic way, easier to pierce the matrix. Although I have grave reservations not only about Israel, but not enamored of a lot of the Jewish politicians in the U.S. The fact of the matter is, though, in terms of international law and a great many other things, the Israeli cause is in its foundation just, and the cause of the Palestinians isn't all as pitiable as it may be. But people have not been told the truth. In the description, not only for last week's show, but for this week and several weeks, I'm going to be posting some pictures of Hezbollah giving the Nazi salute, which also Hamas uses, which Palestinian Islamic Jihad, another Muslim Brotherhood offshoot, uses. The secular PLO use the same gesture. There is no gesture like that in Islamic or Arabic culture. It is the fascist slash Nazi salute, and it is used by these organizations for a reason, and we're going to go into that in part 2. But those of you, and there have been quite a few, who accuse me of being a, quote, Zionist, unquote, or never saying anything critical of Israel, well, you know, it's one thing to talk the talk, it's another thing to walk the walk, and just go to the Spitfire website, Google Zionist, unquote, and quote, fascist, unquote, and see what you find on the Spitfire website. That's probably why I was investigated by the ADL. But to give you an idea of the sort of, this is just the sort of email I used to get when the OJ case was in the news, was dominating the news, and O.J. was innocent, although people didn't know that. But I used to get hysterical emails, and I'm starting to get them now in connection with this, and I'm sure I'll get a lot more. This is from a listener. Dave, I have listened to your show for years, and last night I was really upset. By the way, before I begin this, he's talking about John Loftus here, and this is For the Record 564. Dave, I have listened to your show for years, and last night I was really upset that you had this obvious Bush apologist and Israeli Jewish extremist Zionist Nazi Likud party. Benjamin Netanyahu is a Jewish Nazi, as he hates Arabs just as much as the Arab extremists hate Jews, and you know it. And I'd like to remind you what Mae Brussel said about Elliot Abrams misspelled, Michael Ludeen misspelled, and Richard Perle misspelled, quote, Jewish Nazis, unquote, supporters spouting off his views on the latest Lebanon invasion. In what is the only substantively accurate statement in this entire email, he then goes on, fist off, I think you need to have someone who has an opposing viewpoint and who actually might have been on the ground there seeing what really happened. We're going to be talking about the Middle East matrix later, but that is sort of typical of the sort of stuff that one hears in connection with the Middle East state of affairs. And a lot of it is that they've been deliberately misinformed. They are inside of the matrix, and they don't realize that they're being lied to. And I'm going to attempt to pierce that matrix to, a certain extent. By way of sort of introduction, we're going to talk about, and if actually, you know, I should say that if people want to understand why, for all of the reservations I have, I'm basically supportive of Israel, not because I'm a Zionist, but because basically not only is their cause just in its foundation, and we'll talk about that, but basically the whole world is going fascist and Nazi, and the Israelis are the canary in the mine shaft, whether or not you accept that. And when they get theirs, and they're going to, I think Israel is going to be wiped off the face of the earth, you, boys and girls, Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, you're next, baby. They're going to get theirs first, and they will get theirs. But you're next. So basically, they're the canary in the mine shaft. What happens to them is going to happen to you. And by way of sort of closing this side, by way of introducing some interesting comments by none other than Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, this is from the Financial Times of Friday, March 31st of 2006. In the run-up to the World Cup, Germany was afraid there was going to be a huge outcropping of neo-Nazi activity because of the neo-Nazi's sympathy with Iran. By Hugh Williamson in Berlin, neo-Nazis pose threat to World Cup. Right-wing extremists and neo-Nazis posed a security threat to the Soccer World Cup in Germany this summer, the German government admitted for the first time yesterday. Skipping down. The extremist protests are aimed in part at expressing support for Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Iranian president who caused outrage last year by calling for Israel's abolition and by denying the Holocaust, according to intelligence officials. Just look at the pictures on the Spitfire website of Hezbollah giving the Nazi salute, and you'll understand why basically I'm supportive of Israel with all of the reservations that I've expressed. Because basically I'm an anti-fascist, and when you see what you see with Hezbollah rallies, you go to war against it, and you keep going to war against it until that is destroyed and the people who are exponents of it are either killed or captured. And that's not to say that I advocate nuking Iran or some precipitous thing. I don't know quite what's going to happen, but I don't think it's going to be good. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 565, Middle East Matrix, He Who Tells the Truth Gets Chased Out of Nine Villages, Part 2. This has been recorded on August 20th of 2006. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.